My name is Adil Raja, and I am a freelance journalist, investigative journalist. I'm basically a Pakistan Army officer, third generation Pakistan Army officer, in fact. And it'll be interesting for you to know that my great grandfather was part of the Royal Indian Army, and in the partition in 1947, he chose to join Pakistan because natively we are from Pakistan. And then my dad also joined the Pakistan Army. I joined the Pakistan Army. I took commission in 1999, went there in 96, served there for 22 years. And after retirement, I was a successful businessman, but I started writing there in the English newspapers and the dailies as a columnist. So that gave me a taste, because I always wanted to become a journalist. That gave me a taste of becoming a journalist, in fact.
Yeah, they say the pen is mightier than the sword. Now, do many soldiers agree with that or not?
Actually, Tony, I've been fighting. I was fighting with a gun, and my gun had been replaced with a pen. And definitely, pen is mightier than the sword. Why? Because the impact I'm making, which I believe is huge, considering the topic we're discussing today, as a journalist, what I'm doing really does matter because of the kind of opposition I'm facing, the kind of war I'm fighting, the fight against fascism of the Pakistani military junta, which is part and parcel, which is my previous family, in fact. But now they're fighting me just because I'm using my pen, not my gun. So definitely, pen is mightier than the sword.
Oh,
And
they're
my
trying to keep your mouth shut. But look, before we talk about what's been going on in Kashmir, maybe you could just explain the attempts and the success or otherwise of the intelligence services. Because I realise that they have noticed your activities in London in the English language, getting your message out here as a former Pakistani army officer, and I don't think they're too happy, are they? So can you just explain what's been going on?
I became a British resident, and after I took retirement from the Pakistan Army, I moved permanently to the UK. But at the same time, I had connection with Pakistan. I was traveling six times a year to Pakistan, shuttling between London and Islamabad. But in 2022, I supported the Imran Khan, and I spoke against, because I used my pen against the regime change operation, which was allegedly sponsored by the Americans, by the Biden administration. And because I spoke against the army chief, which is Cardinal Sin, as they say in Pakistan. So I was, taken to task, and I was forced to flood the country, come here to my family, to my wife, and to my kids. And ever since, and I moved in April 2022 permanently. And before that, I was permanently living in the UK starting from 2019, from the December of 2019. And I've been coming and going into the UK since I was a child. So since my mum was here, and my entire maternal family's here, my grandmum was here, my grandparents were here. So it's like London is like a second home to me. The UK is like a second home to me. So I had that opportunity to come here, and I had to make a choice to either take a stand and speak up against the military dictatorship, which is a norm in my country, by the way, and which is enforced by the intelligence arm ISI, or just stay shut and keep on making money, or just prefer money over journalism. But I chose journalism, not a very profitable business, as you know, Tony. Yeah, but I still chose integrity over materialist pursuits, and paid a very heavy price for it. I'm the first person in the history of my country, Pakistan. I'm no more a national of the country. They have cancelled my nationality. Even I'm a stateless person, if we go by that definition. Yeah. So, but first they reported me to the British authorities, because they've got clout here in this country, and they use it under the garb and on the name of counterterrorism cooperation. They got me arrested here by the counterterrorism police under the counterterrorism laws here in the UK, and they got and there was a 9 months long investigation against me by the Southeast Counterterrorism Police, which ended with a no further action and an informal apology, and the police paid for the damages they had caused. I was not much, in fact. They had broken my computer, so yeah, they did that. So if since that didn't go through, the ISI itself, through its serving general, Brigadier General, sued me for defamation using a forum shopping here in the UK. Since UK is the libel tourism capital of the world, that's not me saying it, all right? There's a Freedom House saying it. So I'm fighting a slap legislation right now in the Royal Court of Justice where the ISI is being represented by the top-notch chambers. I don't want to say it, but one of the chamber, the barrister comes from the Doughty Street Chamber, really expensive. I mean, I've heard that Keir Starmer, in fact, founded that chamber. So, got to be expensive, isn't it? So they're spending a lot of money to silence me, and I am crowdfunding my case. So far, I've raised £100,000. So, if I and that's purely crowdfunding through GoFundMe, that tells you, Tony, that my people support me. They believe me. If they would not have supported me, if they had not believed in this fight against fascism, as I call it, do you think they would have given me all this money?
Well, no, I don't. I think you're absolutely right. You know, you've got obviously a lot of support here in London by some very decent people. They may not just, by the way, be, of course, Pakistani nationals. They may be people who are from, you know, been in this country for a long time. But look, you keep mentioning this organization called the ISI. Now, I don't think I've ever seen people like Channel 4 News talking about the ISI. I've occasionally, the BBC, I think, have mentioned it once or twice. Who is the ISI and why are they after you?
ISI is an aberration for inter-services intelligence. It is supposed to be a military intelligence doing the military task, but by design, this intelligence organization has always been partner of, for example, of a CIA, once it comes for to organize the jihad in the Cold War era, if you remember that, against the USSR, that gave them a lot of clout, and then they were playing a pivotal role in the war against global war against terrorism, and that's where they got their relevance because they recruit proxies who are terrorists. And who are these proxies, by the way? So going back to the Cold War era, once the CIA was fighting the so-called jihad against USSR at Afghanistan, they created this mercenaries, international ideological mercenaries who went out of job after the Cold War ended with the breakage of USSR and after they went out of Afghanistan. So they were left jobless and they were taken on. They were left it was left to the ISI to look after them. So ISI groomed them and used them as their proxies in Indian side of Kashmir, and ISIS became an offshoot of ISIS was also there. Al-Qaeda was there, and they had very strong relations with the ISI. So that's why Osama bin Laden was being, you know, sheltered in Pakistan. That was also directly related to the ISI. One of the ISI officer, in fact, walked into the U.S. embassy in Islamabad and told the Americans, and he got the bounty for that as well, mind you. His name was Colonel Iqbal. And Colonel Iqbal is now living in the US somewhere. So he took the bounty and he told them that we are sheltering Osama bin Laden. And then there was a huge manhunt which resulted in the re-election of Obama in the second term, if you remember. So ISI is, as we call it in Pakistan, and there have been books written on it. And ISI has been sued for these terrorism activities in the US. And in the UK, you don't hear much about it because the British establishment uses cooperation of the ISI. It is critical for them to use the cooperation of ISI for the counterterrorism efforts and for bringing back, you know, criminals who hide in Pakistan. There is a huge Pakistani diaspora here, Pakistan origin British here. So most of them, you know, they find safe havens in Pakistan. And if an ISI is not on board, you cannot really apprehend any criminal or terrorist for that matter. So that is why ISI's cooperation is critical, seen as very critical here in Britain. So you don't hear much about them. But in the US and rest of the world, you just have to Google ISI and you'll know a lot about them. It's a notorious organization. But, you know, they've kept their relevance for the world by, you know, recruiting these proxies who are now international ideological mercenaries. And they have been labeled as playing double games, and they have been labeled different things. But I mean, it's a very well-known organization, which has got international tentacles,
Yeah.
and they've
Well,
got
isn't
the
it
might of the
interesting?
Pakistani military incorporated, the money of the Pakistani military incorporated, because it is the intelligence arm of the Pakistani military, and the Pakistani military runs a multi-billion, in fact, as per last estimates, $200 billion business empire based in Pakistan.
Well,
It's a
what? Hang
global
on, hang on.
empire.
What sort of business is?
Oh, wow, you don't know about that. Well, there's a book written by Aisha Siddiqui, Dr. Aisha Siddiqui. She's also living here in London, and she wrote this book. And because of the book, she had to leave the country. It is called The Military Incorporated. At that time, the military incorporated, I mean, you name any business. May it be critical mineral, may it be making cement, may it be making fertilizers may it be the real estate sector, may it be the agriculture sector, may it be mega industries, may it be airlines. Everywhere it is the Pakistani military which is running a business there in Pakistan. The Pakistan Army Chief, in fact, is the patron in chief of those businesses, and they're making billions of dollars per quarter out of these businesses. And they control the Pakistani government because they create a monopoly in Pakistan, a country of 250 million people, mind you, big market economy. So they have to maintain a monopoly over the businesses in the country by making favorable policies. That's why they need to maintain control over the Pakistani government. And that is where they use ISI and the military intelligence as well to carry out political manipulations. Like currently, there's a government of the Penthouse Pirates fame Sharif brothers. They're commonly referred as the Sharif crime family in Pakistan. And they are being, you know, they have been planted, although they just won 17 seats out of 300 seats, but they've been planted in the government by the military because they sign off any policy the military want them to sign. And that is where the military incorporated. You name any business, just name any business, traveling, food. They've got their own butcheries, they've got mega food brands, they've got wedding halls, they've got housing societies, estates, they've got high-rise buildings. I mean, you just name anything, any business sector, and the military is the biggest player in that country.
Well, I mean
At
that it's a fascinating tale you're telling here, and if you actually extract the democratic process from all this, and you have a military which is beholden maybe to a foreign power like the United States, who are running big business, who are in a position to control big business, really this is a fascist system. It's a military dictatorship.
Well, that is how it is, Tony. That's how Pakistan is. And it's not even an open secret. These are published facts. But since you, Tony, you are such a senior journalist here in the UK, and even you don't re realize what I'm talking about, I am introducing you to this fact. So just imagine how easy it is for the ISI to hire fancy barristers and lawyers and go forum shopping here in the UK, and how difficult it is for us to explain a British judge that, judge, listen, what they are doing is they're trying to hoodwink you. They
Yeah.
don't want you to know the
Well,
reality.
they're
They
using
are they're giving you a David Ayring argument.
yeah, they're using lots and lots of money. They are completely selling out their own people. In fact, they're traitors in their own country. But more importantly, what we want to hear is the sort of thing that annoys them. And one of the things that annoys them is what you've got to say. Now, we've had a very important, all over the world's news this week, attack where 26 tourists were killed in Kashmir. Maybe you could just start by saying something about the situation in Kashmir, because it's by no means normal, is it?
No, Kashmir, you know, well, before what really annoys them, let me tell you briefly, what annoys them is, Tony, that they're worshipped, irrespective of whatsoever I've told you. They were worshipped 3 years before the regime change of Imran Khan. They have always been worshipped for 75 years as heroes, irrespective of them losing half the country, East Pakistan, to India, which became Bangladesh. But still, they're respected. They're worshipped, in fact. And that is not the case anymore for the last 3 years because of people like me who are exposing them. We are inside outsiders, mind you. So that is what really hurts them. And that is why there's a crackdown on dissent, which is counterprotective now coming to Kashmir. Well, it's only Kashmir. You guys left Kashmir there, you know. Once the Brits left the subcontinent, it was a bloody
party.
Hang on
a minute. Listen, I'm a Brit. I had nothing to do with that. The man who did it was a guy we nicknamed in central London. In journalists nicknamed him Mountie until he was assassinated allegedly by the IRA, but it may have been by our own security forces or another country because of the amount that he knew loads about the secrets, links between the Nazis and the British at the end of the Second World War, deals which were done. So we don't know why he was killed, but he certainly was. We're talking here about Earl Mountbatten.
That's correct. That's correct. And then, Tony, people say that there are a lot of theories there. They say that there was another Sir Redcliffe was also there. And the Redcliffe Award was, in fact, what created the division. And they say, well, in fact, Winston Churchill had already made up the plan of partition before he left. So Lord Mountbatten was only handed over that file and he just had to, you know, oversee the partition. Oh, there are so many theories. But because Kashmir was left as a bone of contention between India and Pakistan, and because it was a bloody partition, which definitely resulted in resentment spread over decades, and which resulted in three all-out wars and three or four small battles between India and Pakistan, and which resulted in the partition of the remaining half of the country, that is East Pakistan in 1971, and Bangladesh. The bone of contention has always been Kashmir. It has been there and it is still there. So it's a historic problem. But of late, the issue has been that Indians, since they've, they grew as an economy, so they've really, you know, invested a lot of money there in their part of Kashmir and the Indian occupied Kashmir, as we call it. So they are spending a lot of money, but the only money alone cannot solve the problem. So what they are doing is that they're introducing demographic changes, like the Israelis introduced in Israel or in Palestine, and like the Pakistani introduced in Balochistan. Those sort of demographic changes in which you bring another demography and introduce them to another area so that there is a balance between the natives and the people you've introduced. So that's what Indians were trying to do that, but it's not very easy, because the problem in Kashmir is right now in the Indian side of Kashmir definitely is not only a military problem. There's half of the Indian army, 700,000 Indian army is there in Kashmir. Then there is a political issue, a geopolitical issue, a demographic issue. You're trying to introduce new demographics there. Then there are sublime factors where in South Kashmir, where this terrorist incident happened in Pahalgam, that is an area which is a hotbed of separatists, of insurgents, and the insurgents have been traditionally supported by the Pakistan. And again, ISI comes in over here. ISI, the same ISI we are talking about, the same ISI who's carrying out this slap legislation, strategic lawsuit against public participation here in the Royal Court of Justice. The same ISI has got different wings. They, as I told you, they had the proxy elements from the Afghan Jihad era, these international ideological mercenaries who went out of job after the Americans, they just packed up and left after USSR broke. So these guys were given jobs and they were hired and they were sent into the Indian side of Kashmir as freedom fighters. And they were only, you know, there was a U-turn which was taken on this policy in 2006 when General Musharraf was, in that country. And because of the American pressure, where America made a strategic alliance with India to make it a counterweight to China. So the Indians, they pressurized Americans, because Americans always had this clout on the Pakistani military establishment, and they were supporting General Musharraf's dictatorship that, all right, you need to, you know, bring out these mercenaries you have sent into Kashmir. So they were brought back They were brought back, but what happened later was that the Indian, they had suffered for a very long time. In fact, they were sent in the 80s and they stayed there till 2006. Well, they were the Pakistani ISI. They tried the inter-services intelligence. They tried to keep them busy in, playing games or sports and giving them some jobs. They tried to teach them how to become electricians or how to become, instead of electrician, how to become a farmer or something. But this was the fourth generation of mercenaries. They knew nothing but to fight, right? But they're the international ideological mercenaries. So they left the ISI camps and they went back to the Pakistan-Afghanistan border where they were natives of that particular area. As per the admission of the Pakistani defense minister, current defense minister, that it was the Pakistani tribal Pakhtuns, the Pathans. They were the reason we still have got half of the Kashmir, what the Pakistan side have got. So these people went there, and the Indians, what they did, allegedly, they hired the same guys in Afghanistan. Once the U.S. and the International Security Assistance Force, including the British Army, went into Afghanistan, the Indians were there because they were the strategic partners. They hired the same guys, and there was religious declaration against edict against the Pakistani state, that since they are siding with the Americans, so they're infidels, so they have to be killed. So the Pakistanis got a taste of their own medicine. These religious international ideological mercenaries, religious fundamentalists, were launched against the Pakistani state, and the Pakistani state fought them and suffered a lot for 20 years, and I've been involved in that fight as well. So, and then later on, the Balochistan, there were always been separatist elements in Balochistan, even before the partition in 1947. Balochistan was not on board. So the Baloch partition and the Baloch people living in, not only in Pakistan, in Iran and in Afghanistan, they wanted a separate country for themselves. So the Indians allegedly supported the Baloch insurgency, which resulted and many casualties for the Pakistani side. And the latest incident was in which around 400 soldiers were killed in the Jaffa train express. There was a train which was hijacked in Balochistan, and there were around 400 soldiers who were killed by the Baloch separatists. And they were those are the soldiers who were going on leave. The train was hijacked. There was an IED explosion, and then the train was hijacked. And then all these soldiers who were off duty, definitely didn't have much weapons on them. They were taken hostage and later on killed. So that was the biggest incident in recent history. At the
Yeah,
same time, this.
coming on to talking about what's been happening in Kashmir, I'd just like to spell out what's been going on. I noticed Reuters today saying that tensions between India and Pakistan are very high. New Delhi, in India, has mounted a diplomatic offensive against Islamabad in Pakistan, blaming the Pakistanis for a deadly attack that killed 26 people, mostly tourists, in the disputed Kashmir. India has accused Islamabad of a port supporting cross-border terrorism, imposing diplomatic measures, including now downgrading diplomatic ties and suspending a water-sharing treaty, also closing the main land border crossing with Pakistan. So maybe you could just take us through what you think has been going on and who's behind it. What's the purpose of it? Because it's a bit difficult to figure out why any rebel on the Pakistan side would have any kind of benefit in just, it seems, randomly killing 26 tourists.
Unfortunately, whatsoever the Indians are saying at this particular time, they are correct. Why? Let me tell you. Taking you back from where you asked this question, so I was linking this Balochistan incident, the train hijacking incident. Now, the Pakistani military, which is already, which is not respected at all, not worshipped the way they used to be for 75 years. They're in fact hated in the country because of their crackdown on dissent, political dissent, because of their crackdown on people of Pakistan who support Imran Khan, because of jailing Imran Khan and his party members, and because of the atrocities and extrajudicial killings of journalists like Arshad Sharif in Kenya. Because of all their actions, because of this fascism by the Pakistani military, they are not, I mean, not being liked is a lighter word. They're definitely being hated right now in the army, so they need to redeem their reputation, and there is no better way to redeem their reputation than to start a war or to utilize the anti-India hatred. So that is the underlying reason. But the second major reason was that the reason why this Kashmir attack was sold to the Pakistani military establishment was that said that, listen, it is the Indians who are supporting the Baloch insurgents, the insurgents in Balochistan. So we need to send them a message by supporting insurgents in Kashmir, by separatists in Kashmir, because we need to tell them that there is going to be a price to be paid if you're going to support the insurgents or the separatists in Balochistan. So that was how this thing was sold, and it was definitely, as by my sources, and I've got my colleagues there in the Pakistani intelligence community, they say that it was the Pakistani army chief Asim Munir. Asim Munir ordered this operation in Kashmir, this attack on tourists in Kashmir. He ordered it, and these were the proxies, these were the elements which are based in Pakistan, whose leadership is based in Pakistan. They've always been there, you know. It's been an open secret, and they've been attacked, and there have been skirmishes, and there have been so-called surgical strikes before this. So the same elements were used to launch this attack in India, in which unfortunately 26 tourists were killed. And before being killed, they were, very. The saddest part is that before this incident, just a week before this, the army chief Asim Munir in Islamabad, he gave a very fiery speech, which is uncalled for. This is the army chief in uniform giving, addressing the entire nation on national TV and saying that, listen, he gave an anti-Hindu rhetoric in his speech. And he gave a very heavily religious fundamentalist sermon. And he tried to rally the Muslim fundamentalist support for himself. And because he want to portray this image of a macho man, and he needs that image because he considers, but he's actually he wants to match the popularity of Imran Khan. I mean, the previous army chief tried that as well, and he's trying that as well. But it's not going to work till the time there is no war, and till the time the entire nation, because of the nationalistic tendencies in the war, they rally around the army, and well, he in cash. He encashes upon that. So, 1 week after him giving that speech against the Hindus, the people, these tourists were attacked, who were, mind you, and the Indians are going to collaborate this, and if you just do a bit of research, you'll know that their circumcision was checked to know that whether they're Muslims or not, whether they're Hindus. If they're not circumcised, they were shot. That's how they checked them, whether they're Hindus or they're Muslims, and that's how they were shot. And my sources say, they claim, and they are credible sources who've been proven time and again. That's why my credibility got established. That's why I've got this all the support, because whatsoever I say, it becomes a reality. The proof is always in the pudding, which comes forward in a bit later. But and I've been quoted quite extensively about this, but my sources in the Pakistani intelligence community say that it was an operation which was authorized, given greenlit by the Pakistani army chief, General Asim Munir, and the ISI orchestrated this attack through their proxies, and they've got no shortage of proxies. And it was a message sent to India that if you're going to support Balochistan, we are going to open a front inside India or in the areas where you've got trouble. And there are so many areas, so many separatist elements there in India as well. So the proxy war has been reignited because the military is desperate to redeem their reputation, one, and secondly, they want to impose a penalty on India for supporting insurgency and Balochistan.
No,
That's what
it's a fascinating analysis. But you know what? If you can imagine people at the ISI saying, "Well, our deal, he's just working for RAW. He's working for the Indian Secret Service."
Yeah, Tony, they say I'm working for the MI6 as
Yeah,
well.
well, I mean that's it's hilarious. But how would you answer that?
The thing is, the proof is in the pudding, as I always say. And whatsoever I've said, my sources in the ISI, these are the people who do not agree with the policies of the army chief, Asim Munir, who is always, prioritizing his personal interests over the national interest. And because of that particular reason, there is a political instability in the country for 3 years continuously. And that is why the people's mandate has been stolen, has been proven. In fact, that's why the Pakistan Democracy Act is there in the US Parliament. The main opposition, the Pakistani military junta right now, they've got is in the overseas Pakistanis because they've cracked down on dissent domestically. But the overseas Pakistanis, since they're well read, they've seen the world, they're well traveled, they know, what's really going on in Pakistan. They've seen democratic systems, so they're challenging their rate. So whatsoever I've said has always it's been proven right, firstly. Secondly, there's a history to what I'm saying. The ISI has been conducting these operations. It's not that this is the first time. Then the present army chief, who is under whose orders allegedly this attack has been conducted, once he was himself the director general of the ISI, the previous mega attack was conducted around 4 years ago in it was in Pulwama, and there was again a warlike situation between India and Pakistan. So at that time, the same army chief was the director general of the ISI, and well, this modus operandi has always been there. The people, I mean, Indians are openly carrying out assassinations of the Kashmiri leaders, of the Khalistani leaders, and on the Pakistani
But I
soil.
mean, what you're saying is this is an attempt to take the fight to the Indians. But then I can also imagine that since the ISI has got all its business interests, actually war can be very good for business too, can't it?
Yeah, that's true. They've planned it very well. The plan is the first casualty of war, and they've ignited the war, and now they are panicking, and now they want their media cells and their media assets to blame the Afghans for whatsoever has happened there. They're saying, well, blame it on the Afghans. We really don't want to take it any further. Why? Because the Indians have, instead of attacking Pakistan, because they were ready, the Pakistanis did it. Another proof is that even a few hours before the attack, the Pakistani defense were on highest alert. They were ready. They were expecting an attack. And another proof is that their attack was, they were on such a high alert that just early morning today, they have, yesterday, in fact, they had captured an Indian Border Security Force booby who is trapped by them. So he just crossed over while walking, he says, to the Pakistani side, and the Pakistanis were in the high alert and they have arrested him. And he's now with the Pakistanis. So the Pakistanis were ready for any attack. But what the Indians instead did was that they're the upper riparian state. And there is an Indus Water Treaty, and Pakistan is a heavily water-stressed country right now. And there is a huge political issue right now in the province of Sindh, which is towards the Indian Ocean. They're not getting their due share of water from the Indus, and there is an Indus Water Treaty, brokered by the World Bank, which ensures that Pakistan gets its fair share of water,
Yeah,
or
well,
at
the
least
Indians are now in
different
the
share.
process of cutting that off. But look, I just want to ask you
Yeah,
one other
they've
question.
suspended, unilaterally suspended the Indus
Yeah.
Water Treaty. And now that's funny, Tony, because as for the Pakistani nuclear doctrine, if the Indus water stream is cut off, that means that the Pakistani nuclear threshold has been crossed and they are going to launch a nuclear strike.
Well, look, let's hope they don't. I just wanted to ask you finally about the involvement of the Israelis, because I've noticed, say, for example, in Myanmar, Burma, that the Saudis have been funding the Rohingyas and the Burmese army has been being funded by the Israelis. So there's this interference in a lot of countries, which are Muslim countries, with the terrible twins of Israel and Saudi actually fueling these conflicts. I wonder if there's any of that going on, to your knowledge, in Pakistan, India.
Well, Tony, as but the theory goes that the Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, was about to accept Israel diplomatically, but Pakistanis have to agree to it. And Imran Khan was the prime minister at that time. And Imran Khan said absolutely not, because there was a political decision. Imran Khan refused. And that is what contributed towards the regime change operation of Imran Khan, because the Pakistani military junta, which are the real power brokers in the country, they wanted diplomatic relations with Israel. And the proof is that recently it has been widely reported in the media as well that the Pakistani delegation, a highly powered delegation of Pakistan, they've been visiting Israel since, even though Pakistan does not accept Israel diplomatically, but they traveled to Israel through UAE by sponsored by an Israeli NGO called Sharaka. Right, and it's based in UAE as well. And well, there are allegations that were funded by Mossad. I don't know about that. I asked them directly. I wrote an article about them. They didn't care to respond, so I mentioned that as well. But the Pakistani military establishment wants cordial relationship with Israel, and they are, you know, striving to create some sort of a bilateral relationship. And as for the policy, you know, spelled out by Sharaka, they say that in the next decade or so, we see ties normalizing with Pakistan because they want to, you know, maintain diplomatic relations.
Well, this
with
is another reason, of course, why Imran Khan has been shut out. So we've only got half a minute. Can you just let listeners know whereabouts they can find you and follow you, please, Adil?
Yeah, so you can follow me on the X, formerly Twitter, at Soldier Speaks. You can find me on Substack on soldierspeak.substack.com. And you'll find, if you want to follow me for my private vlogs, I am on Patreon as well, patreon.com/soldierspeaks. And my website is soldierspeaks.org.
Adil Raja, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tony. Thank you.